Welcome to Changing Academic Life. I'm Geraldine Fitzpatrick, and this is a podcast series where academics and others share their stories, provide ideas, and provoke discussions about what we can do individually and collectively to change academic life for the better.
On your own terms. That's not just a platitude. It's how Johanna Stadelbauer has navigated her career to date. I have the pleasure of presenting this conversation with Johanna. Johanna's an anthropologist by background and currently heading up researcher development at the University of Graz, where she's head of the Research Careers Campus Graz. Johanna has a really interesting journey herself, from a PhD and a postdoc in anthropology to then deciding to quit the postdoc because it wasn't working for her. She then talks about working with various NGOs and doing that work part-time because of the health issues that had resulted from previous work experiences, and then how she eventually came back to academia for this researcher development role. So her work now is squarely focused on creating a supportive and kind academic environment. She talks about how they're working to establish various structures for supporting postdoctoral researchers and for helping to create community. And this includes initiatives like a writing retreat and a fiasco fest that I really loved, and various peer mentoring initiatives, all with the aim of creating better workplaces that will result in improving research and researcher well-being, and also fostering that sense of community. I think Johanna is a role model herself for how to navigate a career path with integrity and authenticity and resilience, and defining work on your own terms. She's really clear on her own boundaries and what she needs to do to feed herself and to look after her own well-being. And this conversation reminds us of the value of peer support, of clear communication, of telling people their contributions matter, that they matter, and to take time to savour the good. She also reminds us that we all do have some agency to define work on our own terms. Enjoy this conversation with Johanna.
Johanna, thank you so much for joining me. And I'm going to read the first little paragraph from your webpage, because it says, "I'm an anthropologist working in research and development at the University of Graz. I'm head of the Research Careers Campus, and my mission is a more fun and kind academia." So those strands point to what I'd really love to explore with you. First of all, what's the journey that brought you from anthropology to working in research and development?
Thank you, Geraldine. It's an honor, because I really like your podcast, and it's called Changing Academic Life. So I think that's something we are both invested in our own ways, and maybe even both as with a love for anthropology as well. And it's a big question: how does one go from anthropology to researcher development? And I try to answer it now, but I always feel, or I have the conviction, that an anthropology degree prepares you for every role. And it's an asset to have in every job, because I have so many friends who studied with me who use their anthropology skills in, I don't know, in the innovation sector, in the business sector, many different roles. And personally, I like to work with people who are very curious about humans and very aware of society and how it shapes and it's stratified, like how gender roles in society shape how we interact with each other, how class and our family background shapes our pathways, and all the different discriminations there are. So I think that's an asset to have in any kind of job. And personally, I came into research and development via equality work, and I came to equality work via doing gender studies in anthropology. And I have a background in thinking about methods as well in anthropology. So that comes in handy if you can do qualitative research. You know what needs your target group have. If you are serving a specific target group, you know how to find out what they want. And through my previous roles, I also know how to make a program, and I know how to develop offers, how to make a concept for something, and how to evaluate it and see if it has an impact. So that's the short of it.
I love that. You've just talked about really clear skills, ways of thinking that can be transferable in lots of different domains. I mean, the fact that you've brought it here. What about the decision process to get into research development? So did you did a PhD in anthropology in at Graz, and did you do postdoc research? How was that postdoc journey?
Yes, so I studied in Graz and I did some field work. So for my MA, I did some field work in New Zealand, which I've told you about previously because it's sort of roughly the area
It's
where you.
roughly near Australia and a long way away.
In that it's quite a bit quite far away from Austria. And for my PhD, I did field work in Austria with expatriates, so people who were here for short-term work stays, so 2 3 years, 4 years, 2 years, and were very mobile. So I had a life of going to different companies around the world, and I caught them at the time where they were in Austria. And after that, a new anthropology professor from Germany came to Carinthia, and he wanted someone from Austria to familiarize him with the Austrian academic cultures. And so I got that job. And so I did a postdoc for 2 years in Carinthia, which is it's a great university. Everyone is really friendly there, and I was let into all the working groups for equality and my own qualitative research network and so on. But after 2 years out of a 6 year contract, I realized this is too strenuous. So I have too little inspiration for research projects, and I have too high a workload because I was also responsible for the curricular development. So I had to plan the department's teaching program for the year and give all the students their degrees, basically. And so I had students in my office all the time. Yes, but
That's
that
that
wasn't
sounds
the
like a lot to ask of a first, second year out postdoc.
Yeah, but at that time it was only me and my boss at the department, and of course a brilliant secretary who was basically doing my job. So I mean, I did a lot of it, but she had institutional knowledge, so that was brilliant.
I'm just curious if the role had have been less of the teaching curriculum development and more space for research, do you think? Could you imagine? I know it's imagining a world that didn't happen, but could you imagine that you may have been able to get inspiration for research?
It might have been I had more brain space, yes. But I mean, that's still something I'm very proud of. I even advocated for myself. I went to the vice rector for staff and told him that this is untenable. And then he reduced my teaching, which was useful. But I just really lacked. I was in a slump after the PhD, basically, as is apparently normal in academic careers.
Who am I
Yeah,
now?
so, and I didn't have between conferences, my boss telling me I need to apply for third party funding, this curriculum development. I had no inspiration for any sort of direction I wanted to go in with my research. I mean, I started a project, but I abandoned it gladly after I quit that job. And I always had this question in the back of my mind: is that right for me? And so I went to therapy and talked it out with the therapist and said, I can't make this work. Everyone is saying you need to work 60 hours. I cannot work 60 hours and I don't want it. And he
No,
said, well,
that's
then find your own way to do it. And then I just quit. So that's,
that's brave.
yeah. But it's, yeah, I've talked this through with colleagues, and some of them said, well, the whole university basically said he's brave because he's a very small university. So it was, I got lots of calls saying, why did you quit from the dean upwards and downwards? And everyone was sort of applauding me a little bit for this decision. But I had a boyfriend then who had his own flat. And so I had sort of a secure financial background in that sense. And I was then able to have a job for 1 or 2 years where I earned only 1,300 euros. So, by having this living space, basically, and so I had the feedback from other people who aren't as financially secure in academia that it's actually not that brave, you know, and who are still in academia because that's the only way they can have an income for their whole family, you know, which is their parents, sister, and so on.
It's
So,
hard, isn't it? And the trade-offs
yeah.
and the circumstances, they're not easy decisions. If you didn't have that safety net, maybe you couldn't have done it and you would have been like some other people, as you just said, who stayed on.
I
And
would
then
still
there's the
have,
cost of that untenable.
yeah. I would still have done it. I'm pretty sure of it. Because if you just suffer too much, then or you can't make it work, then I've always been taught by my mother to leave things behind, and she has modeled that basically, and so that's always my approach. If it's more sad making than it's happy making, then I'm not doing it. So I'm a bit uncompromising in that. But it's important to recognize also that privilege that not everyone has when they make the career decisions. And then I thankfully found lots of different jobs through, none of them through regular applications, but through networks that I already had. So one woman from Carinthia knew a man in Graz who ran an NGO for youth and equality work. And so I worked with him for a year on a project on anti-Semitism that was funded from a political education body and from the municipality. So that was also a time when I had many health issues, I think, due to having been so stressed out earlier. So at that time, a chronic illness manifested itself. So I had a 15-hour job and I was able to go there and do all of it and still be very chronically ill. But that thankfully got better over time. And these mini NGO contracts were quite good for that because I didn't have to be in the office all the time. So,
Nice.
and that gave
Nice.
me the start into this NGO work, NGO research education work, where you sort of do needs analysis and then prepare educational concepts from them. With this specific background was anti-Semitism prevention. And then I moved through a woman who works at the university or worked at the University of Graz in the equality office for 30 years. I think she connected me with another NGO, which is the Männerberatung in Graz. So the Men's Counseling Center, also a decades old institution, which has a research part, which is also quite old already. And they do lots of EU Daphne violence preventative grants. So they apply for grants a lot and have about 10 to 15 ongoing projects which are funded by the EU or by different health funding bodies or by municipality, province, and so on, or even by people who contract them for institutions that have a problem with violence or sexual abuse, for example, and need them to come in and do research and then find out how to make the institution better. So I got that connection and they took me on in five different research projects in a 15-hour contract. So that was lots of business trips nicely. So I got to go to Sofia and to Southern Tirol and to Barcelona for all these EU
Nice,
projects. Yeah.
very good.
But all of them were on the topic of preventing sexual abuse against boys or sexualized violence and discrimination against boys, and training people who work with children to create an environment where these children can tell them that this is happening. So I did that for 3 years until I couldn't take it anymore, because that's also a job where you would need a lot of community with your colleagues and a lot of supervision. And through this third party funding framework, there wasn't really a lot of time to spend time with the colleagues in the office, because it was, well, the colleagues were all over Europe, basically. And the people who headed the institute also had quite a bit on their plate. So I quit that then, and that there we come to 2020.
So that's just another example of you being very reflective of what's going on for me, what do I need, what's working for me now, and when is it not working anymore and time to go. Like your mother role model again.
Yeah, and by that time I also had this chronic illness, so that taught me never to do any more than I think I can take. I really, that manifested in 2016, and then in 2020 I was still so much in the throes of it that I always stated my boundaries very clearly to every employer. And I'm also really proud of, I've had, while I was working at the NGO, I was also working at the German university remotely to do also violence prevention. And that was a, I think, 4 month or 6 month remote contract. And I did a curative retreat during that, because in the Austrian state, you can go on curative retreats, you know, so for the chronic illness. So I had a job in Germany, in the German system, and a job in Austria, both of them part-time and partly remote. And I told everyone, I'm now going on this curative retreat because I need it. And I somehow made it work through all that administration, and both employers were just happy with it. And so I was basically on a journey since 2016 to tell everyone my boundaries and the conditions under which I want to work. And
that's good.
Yeah.
You said the people made it work or were happy with it. And you also, when you said before that you quit the first postdoc job, and so many people said why, and in the end were supportive in that. Were you surprised by people's support? Like, were you sort of anticipating more pushback, or that people would not want you to be holding your boundaries and do what they wanted?
No. I was neither surprised nor did I anticipate that it would be uncomfortable. I mean, obviously, my boss, very much when he brought me on as a postdoc, saw himself in the role as supporting my career. And looking back, I can understand everything he did as trying to be supportive when I was only 30 and not having been in academia for very long. I didn't recognize this. And I recognized it more as him putting pressure on me and reacted as such. And in that sense, I felt very bad about quitting this job after 2 years. And he was off on the journey with me for a long time. In fact, in that talk where I told him I quit, he said he would try to negotiate a development contract for me to keep me on for longer.
Yeah.
I just said no, thank you. And then obviously he told me, well, then I'm not going to support you anymore, which also wasn't necessary. But I managed, despite being so strong with my boundaries. I think everyone remembers me, not in a adversarial manner. So he still called me up 2 years later to ask, can I come back for half a year, because someone has just gone on maternity leave.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's nice.
So it's just, you know, a good message that you can hold your boundaries and make that work.
Yeah, I think if you're generally a nice person to work with and respectful of the people and to let
it's
them
also,
know.
It's also just interesting for people who are in leadership roles or employing people like postdocs, that tension of wanting to support people's career development and recognizing the pressures of the current environment and system that we're in, and often that does, you know, this inadvertently translate into sort of pressures to play the game more and work the long hours and tick all the boxes. And
well, on that, if I had just not had more knowledge about how academia works, and if he had just explained why he wants me to do this, that, and the other, and in
Ah.
what way this would contribute to my path, I might have understood and not
Yeah.
rejected it so much. So he just said, you, Johanna, now it's time. You're on the 6-year contract to apply for third party funding, and I just didn't understand. I didn't understand that I now needed to be the PI of my own project, and I need to develop leadership, and I need to go out there with my own ideas and be independent. And he also explained none of it, and there was also no structure in place, like a postdoc office or something that would have drawn me in to explain me these things somehow. And he didn't really do much of explaining, because all of them in that generation, they all learned by doing, basically. And I tried for the longest time to just model what everyone else was doing without really understanding why they were doing it. Like, going to lots of conferences, I guess that's good, and not really having an intention behind it, other than that I saw what they were doing. And then, you have your people who stand up in front of training for women, career training for women, and say, well, you're going to work on the weekends, it's going to be hard. And so all of these messages I took on board and thought, okay, some people say this, so some people must also do this, and where do I fit in that? And that was also what led me to quit, because I thought, if there's no one else who does it like I do it, who does it to my abilities with weekends and family time and friends and going to the sauna and stuff like that, then how am I going to do this? And how will I be where I need to be with all these impermanent contracts and so on? But all of that resolved very quickly after I left this job, because despite having then these many, many contract jobs, I felt there's so many people who want my skills, and they are also appreciative. And the NGO world, is not shy with giving praise than academia was for me. And there's not a reviewer around every corner who you have to network with. There's just people who are sort of happy for the mission, wanting to end violence, or wanting to engage youth, or wanting the world to be a much better place. And they celebrate everyone who comes on board, basically, despite the obviously funding situation being shit and stressing. But they, yeah, even that equality office in Germany, they were really, really appreciative and said, so nice that you are here with your skills, and just took me with my remote contract. And I got to meet everyone in the university, because I did a project on preventing sexualized harassment on campus. So I had to do interviews with everyone, from the president to IT service to all the deans and so on. And they just welcomed me as the strange Austrian. And so lots of healing experiences after academia.
Ah, good.
And this stress about temporary contracts resolved itself a bit by me thinking, ah, okay, I have something that actually is in demand, or there are things happening for me, and I have a good network. But that doesn't mean that I wasn't really happy when I got my first permanent contract in 2021.
And
And
what was
since,
your first permanent contract?
well, in 2020, then, when I didn't want to work on preventing sexualized abuse anymore, another friend of mine said, oh, there's a maternity cover at the University of Graz to work with researchers. And then I thought, oh, that's going to be very traumatizing if I do
Going back into the
that.
university.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've resolved everything from the last, from since 2016. But I did it anyway, and in that job interview, my colleagues are still fondly remembering when they interviewed me, that I said, well, I cannot work on a Friday because that's when I get massages. So take it or leave it. And sadly, I now have to work on Fridays because I'm much better and also have 40 hours now. But they nevertheless, I took this maternity cover, and it was working with doctoral researchers. And then, actually already at the end of this year, the vice rector for research, who is now the president of the Austrian Science Fund, who we were working for, he wanted to do something for postdoctoral researchers. And then we started a needs assessment and talking to a third of all the postdocs the university had, and then together with him, very closely developing measures. And by the time he got the call to become the president of the Austrian Science Fund, that was all basically prepared, and someone needed to give me a permanent job. So they did it. And since then, since 2021, end of 2021, I had joy for 40 hours a week on a permanent contract to build up this postdoc office. And now, 5 years, no, 3, 4 years later, we established a new unit that now houses the doctoral researcher services, the postdoc office, and is also developing services for mid-career researchers. And I'm now its boss. So
Lovely.
I'm very happy.
Oh, that's just a lovely journey. The holding your boundaries, the way things work out, the way that you can bring through the skills and knowledge and expertise that you have, and pointing out along the way, like the critical things that we often don't think about, that the conversations that we have with people are so important. So no one told you the why, because we just assume that everyone knows, because it just is the environment that we're in. So not understanding why some of the things were being asked or suggested or pushed, and then the messages that you were getting were, well, of course you've got to work weekends, and like makes me really reflect about how we're messaging, and how explicit we are with people to explain. And also, like, how many times as a researcher working in a university did someone say to you, "So nice that you are here with your skills"?
Yeah, not so many
And wouldn't that be wonderful if
Yeah.
your professor said to you, "So nice that you are here with your skills"?
Yeah, I have this card still here above me, and that I got when I came to Lüneburg in Germany, and that Christmas card where it says that we are so happy that you're here with your skills. And it's, even though it's a Christian Christmas card for some reason, because she had it lying around, I still have it, because it's so important to me that I was able to make this switch, and that I was able to meet these people who were sort of healing me a little bit. Yeah.
And it's such a small gesture, and look at the impact that it's still having. The fact that you
Yeah.
do have the card there, that it's something that you remember. And when you were talking about it, the way your face softened and lit up as well. Just remembering, I don't know, it's almost like you were re-basking in the glow of that appreciation. Such a small gesture, but so impactful.
Yeah. And with these messages, I try not to stress any researchers out in my job now. I don't know how good I am at that, but I try to tell stories in my workshops about people who make it work 20 hours a week, you know, and many different stories of all the people I know who, because I'm now seeking out these people who made their own path that is not like this story of you have to work weekends and you cannot have friends. So I'm always looking for the stories, and then I'm telling them to people, and I can also see the impact of this, because I invited this friend of mine, for example, who has always worked in the same university and now has a permanent job there. And she comes from a Gastarbeiter, or rather not a Gastarbeiter, a refugee family. And I invited her to tell this to all of our postdocs at one of our annual events. And she actually inspired one person who also cannot be mobile because he cares for his parents, to ask for a permanent job, and he now has one. So,
No,
well,
that's
probably that wasn't the only thing that inspired him. Probably it's his, you know, skills and research brilliance, and his negotiation prowess. But I saw he was talking to her afterwards, and so I'm thinking, yeah, that's a
Oh,
little
that's
bit
good.
my contribution. And yeah.
So when you talk about fun and kind academia, is that your personal mission in your role?
Yeah, the fun and kind, that's the kindness aspect of it. That would be more the be kind to yourself, you know, and seek out the people who are also collaborative and like solidarity. That was always what I tried. When I was working in academia, I did lots of peer group work. So this peer group for qualitative methods, alumni work, everything that brought people together, female accountability groups, though I don't really like accountability, so that didn't work very much, but just the female solidarity part of it. And I tried that as far as I could take it, basically, this solidarity. And I found it ends where someone needs to fulfill things for their contracts, and then they can't collaborate anymore because they need people on a higher level to collaborate with them, or other, or yeah, actual instances of power abuse, for example. I had a boss once who made me write a very bad review of someone who she didn't like, and that was my very first publication ever. She just said, "Well, put in this one sentence," and I just put it in, and I obviously feel bad about it. It was like this wasn't very original or something, so it wasn't the worst thing ever, but obviously an instance of power abuse because I was in my first job ever. Well, I'm not going to go into more details about this, but many times actually I cried when I experienced that other people aren't as or cannot be or have been formed in such a way by the system that they cannot be collaborative and they cannot be kind to each other. And now it's not that I'm taking revenge on the system, it's basically just that I'm taking a solution-focused approach and drawing out all the things where people are nice to each other and where structures are working so that they can be nice to each other, where they are establishing new structures together. And there are so many instances of this anyway. When we talk, the postdoc office does a lot of influencing on LinkedIn and in our workshops and public discussions and through speakers and so on. We always try to acknowledge the harming structures or the bad things that are happening, but also, and that they are structural, but also the solutions that individuals find, and that they're actually things like Kohara, big movements where that are aimed at changing the structures. And it's not everything is not doom and gloom, and there are so many people who get together and form movements. So
So
that's
just for
fun and kind is just focusing on the nicer things that make it better for us.
just for people who may not be familiar with it. Kohara is an initiative at European level, and it's the Coalition for Advancing Research Assessment. And they're part of really trying to shift some of the structural issues.
Yeah, reforming what we acknowledge as a research, good research performance. So where doing things for your university also counts, and doing things for the students also counts, and doing things for society also counts as much as an impact factor, and moving away from that impact factor as to not permit too much scientific fraud as well. So that's my understanding of it.
And also it's very good at acknowledging the collegiality aspect and the fact that it's not the lone research, but there are multiple roles that contribute to research outputs.
No. Obviously, now I work for the rectorate of a university. So I also can't go around and say working at the university is shit or working in academia is shit. Because, first of all, I don't believe working at the University of Graz is shit because I enjoy quite a lot and I know a lot of people who like it a lot. But it wouldn't be good neither for my mission nor for my employer if I told everyone how harmful academia is. Because I want the people to thrive in academia and I want them to change academia. And all of these, for example, female mathematicians at our department, despite the fact that they are all basically competing with each other, you never notice that because they just are so supportive, mentoring each other, mentoring people in other countries, putting up lunch clubs, and everything. And so these are actually the people who are going in the university committees and so on. So they make it a livable experience. But there is a tension between speaking for an employer, wanting your employer to recruit great people who
Yes.
also benefit the collegial aspect of our togetherness here at the university, and to be seen by people as just saying, well, everything is great and we are so collegial. And I think I as an anthropologist, I know everything is power relations and everything is, structure shapes how we interact, and there's many bad things going on, in short. But I also believe we have agency to shape it, and I want people to get together
So
to make.
what do you think? You talked about solutions focus, like there are structural issues, and I think that one of the things about the anthropology background is sitting in the middle of all that messy complexity. So the structural issues, and you talked about solutions focused and the agency. So what do you think that either you promote through your office or that you do in your work? What are the key areas of agency that you think make a difference, or maybe some examples of initiatives?
Well, I've had to accept that I have limited scope in my work, so I also have to rely on the people I work with, so the postdocs themselves, to do things for themselves. And I can't change many of the structures which they would want to change, for example, if needed. Things that postdocs said in 2020, 2021 that they want changed still haven't changed, because some of them are at the faculty level, for example, where I have limited influence. So a very wise professor, who is now a professor, once told me, well, you can also rely on the people to fight for themselves. And that helped me a lot. She's one of the creators of the Network Against Power Abuse in Academia. So she has had the experience from a PhD candidate onwards that she was able to actually establish structures that make academia a better place. So she founded PhDNet at Max Planck, and then she founded this Network Against Power Abuse, and she now has about 100 ERC grants. I'm over exaggerating. Anyway, she's brilliant. And that, after 3 years of the postdoc office, where I saw people, the university still, well, people still come to me with the same complaints, like there's not much transparency, information isn't being passed down to me. I'm actually being prohibited from going into some committees. I don't actually know how things work. Yeah, it was a good conversation with her to know that's not talking about any initiatives right now. That's just talking about how I survive in my job, in which people, come to me with problems every day. The problems that not necessarily stem from our university either, that they had in their last university, and it challenges them still in their daily work here. So I try to give competent advice. For example, if you have experienced power abuse in a former job, I can now tell you five people who you can talk to. So that's how I work, by being accessible for the bad things that can happen to you, and then knowing how who to connect you with, and knowing, having insider knowledge basically into many different things, many different parts of the researcher experience, and then relying on people to do it themselves basically, and asking them to check back in with me and report, but go out and seek the solutions themselves. And we have a conflict resolution contact point. So the university has many structures you can send people to, and there are also no many structures outside the university. That's now for conflicts, but the researcher experience is much more than conflicts. And I try to make myself as knowledgeable in all the things like publishing or career development or anything else. And in terms of programs, we used to run a peer mentoring program. Now we have a workshop where you learn how to give collegial advice and support in a structured manner. We have a fiasco fest, which celebrates failure and
Oh,
creates this
lovely.
community. It's really funny that a psychology professor thought it up and came to me when we started the postdoc office, and then we made the concept, the two of us, and it's people sharing their tops and flops and looking at the top and flop CVs that they have, and then just drinking a little bit afterwards. as far as they are comfortable, and then burning all of their fiascos. That's the short of it. But she gives obviously competent psychological advice on how to prepare yourself for the inevitable setbacks that will be part of any career, basically. And that serves the purpose of also getting people together and talking in a way that they don't usually talk, or maybe they don't have so many areas in their own workplace where they can open up and can see, oh, okay, someone else is having exactly the same issues. And that also happens at the writing retreat. We have a yearly retreat for 3 days where which includes time in the sauna, if you want. So someone told me once that that's the first experience of academic sisterhood that they had in the sauna at the writing retreat with other researchers that they've never seen before. And so, but the writing retreat is actually like structured writing time with a writing facilitator where you get 3 meals a day and your schedule is being taken care of for you. And she just tells you when to write and she helps you with any issues that come across, and she makes you go out to exercise or to take a walk, and afterwards it's just holidaying in this resort, basically. And these are all things that serve to form the community, and people will then get in WhatsApp groups together or just see each other again and have seen each other previously. And so we work a lot with that researcher well-being through researcher well-being and community, having people work on their careers. So I don't go around and hit them on the head with the career word or the career planning. I just try to create spaces that are first educational for them or hit any spot that they like needing to finish a paper or needing to know how to perform in an interview for a professorship, but also do it with nice people. And that's the approach, basically. I think I said three main popular programs.
Can I dig in on a couple of those? So I love the Fiasco Fest. That's brilliant. And the writing retreat. You said at the beginning you have a program where you talk to people about you're not doing the peer mentoring anymore, but you're training people in how to do the collegial advice. Could you say a little bit more about that? Like
Yes, so we're
what could be a tip or a trick for that?
okay. Well,
Work.
the genesis of that is that for 3 years we had peer groups, so they spent a year with each other, and that's also our approach. We believe the community already has knowledge and resources, and they just need to be brought together. They don't necessarily need to be taught anything. They just need to connect with each other to share that. And there is a model that's called collégiale Fallberatung in French Canadian, collégial développement collégial, and in English, action items, I think, or something,
Action
action
learning
learning.
sets.
Yes, exactly. So it's all basically the same concept. And at the start of each peer group, they were taught this method by a trainer practically. And then that's what they would do in their sessions. And now so these peer groups, so we have 350 postdocs, and eight or so always applied for this. And everyone from the other postdoc offices around the world always said, wow, that's impressive. No one applied, wouldn't apply for something like this at our university. But now it seems to be something we need to wait for another 2 years until we have the interest again. So we had only 4 people apply this year. So what we offer now is just the methods training. So how to sit together, raise an issue, and then in a specific agenda, go through the issues where the group develops solutions for you. You are not allowed to say anything, and then you are allowed to react to what they said. And then you could together maybe map out the plan for you to actually take action. And then a week later, a month later, 2 months later, you meet the group again, and then you can report how that issue went. And we also use this for supervisor training. So we have a group that's called Supervisor Network, and some of them were previous graduates of this peer mentoring, and some just rather experienced university professors, and they got all together to discuss critical situations from their supervisory practice. And I saw in that they presented it this year in April that doing this for 3 years has influenced the university somehow.
Nice. Like towards more supportive supervisory practices or dealing with
Just
situations more
people have
constructively.
caught on to this idea of you can do something with a peer group. It's there is a platform where you can find these peers, and there are tools, and it's an acknowledged concept now, and a method, and a professional form of getting together and improving your practice, basically. And this is now a group made up of senior postdocs and established professors, and I hope with this new method training that also goes into all the faculties, or all the other universities where the people might go to, and
Yes.
they have some topic, be it supervision, be it, I don't know, just career decisions, and then they can say, oh, there's actually structured methods, and we could meet once a month or something like that. And so, yeah, I think that has potential, and
Yeah,
it's
that's
obviously,
lovely.
it was not me, but I wasn't the first person who thought of
Yeah.
this. And
Yeah,
our.
I'm actually an action learning set facilitator trained. So, and
Oh!
it's brilliant to hear how the transition from the more structured, you meet, depending on what model you use, 6 sessions and there's the commitment. And this sounds like it's taking the principles and working with the reality of people being busy and letting them interpret the principles to meet when they want and as often as they want. It's brilliant.
Yeah, maybe can you say it briefly about the action learning sets, because it's probably sounding better when it comes from you.
It is a peer mentoring process, isn't it? And often the way it's more traditionally set up, and I always had the question in my mind about how well it works in academia to get the commitment for people to turn up. But normally you have 5 or 6 people, you have a facilitator who will role model how to structure a conversation. The people agree to get together in sort of regular period, like could be once a month or whatever, maybe for about 5 or 6 meetings. At the beginning, usually everyone goes around and just says what they might talk about, what could be an issue, and then the group decides which one they focus on, and then exactly the process that you talked about. Although what I was taught was more about instead of the group coming up with solutions, the group coming up with the questions to help the person think through. And then at the end, they can bring in some ideas or solutions themselves. So,
Yeah, that
anyway.
was what I
Yeah.
also
Yeah.
understood it to
Yeah.
be. Also, that
Yeah.
element where you are not allowed to say anything, is that also in your action learning sets? Whether.
Person who brings the problem, they are responding to the questions and they're not listening to other people just talking about their own problems.
So there's like a round where you say, does anyone want to bring a case for today,
Yes.
basically?
Yeah.
And then you bring the case, and then people can ask mini questions just if they haven't understood, and then they discuss without you involving yourself. So in that, the way that I have learned it, not the action learning set, but the collegiale Fallberatung,
Yeah.
you sit there for about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, listening to the people expound on what you do. And also, Geraldine, we did that in our ethno psychoanalysis supervisory group that we had for field work, which was the Balint model. Do you know the Balint model from
No.
psychotherapy? I think
No.
psychotherapists get together to reflect on critical cases from their work
Yeah.
in the Balint group model. And we did that when I was a PhD candidate, or when I did field work still. We had a group with a supervisor who was psychoanalytically trained and also an anthropologist. And someone said, I had this interview, I'm now going to tell you about it, or I had this in situation in my field work. And then the people were discussing it on the basis of emotions that this brought up. So it was a way to make visible relationships in field work through the emotions of other people who have just heard what you were talking. And you could then see something happening in this group that you mightn't have realized was present as a topic in your field work or was a relationship issue in your field work. And this is what I did when I was a researcher, and it's not dissimilar, say, to what the peer groups are doing, but
Yeah.
we have a facilitator come in who
Nice.
does this training in the methods. And I enjoy that element where other people are talking about your problem and you can lean back and
Yes.
see, ah, that's
I hadn't
interesting,
thought
you know.
about that angle. Yeah. The other thing that I'd love to hear more about, you talked about the research of well-being and community building, and that was a point you brought up at the end, and some education around that. So what are some of the key planks of that one?
Oh, that's just that was just to say that I don't say we're a career center. We're a center that strives to create good environments for researchers to feel well at work, basically. So the
Okay.
mission isn't foremost to develop your career. The mission is to have a good working environment and feel well in yourself. And from that then stems everything else, basically. The concept would be take care of yourself first and look at your resources, have a focus on what feeds you, what nurtures you. Yesterday I heard someone saying Genuss, what's the word in English?
Enjoy,
Yeah, but
enjoy, or
more, you
appreciate,
know,
yeah, it's sort of this savor,
yes,
appreciate
savoring,
the, yeah.
savoring. And
Yeah.
that's my approach when I get together with people in coaching. So that's my approach. We always have food for people, you know. And in fact, people who leave our university say to me, "Thanks, Johanna, for all the free food of the last 3 years." But we never do an event that has not any benefit for your career. So everything is informational and everything is networking and everything is actually very important information for you. But it's around eating, it's around being in nature, it's around asking yourself how long hours can I work or what do I do to recharge and where are the people who can help me recharge and what's my community and what are all the supportive environments I can map out and how can I put them into place and how can I defend those boundaries when once I have identified what feeds me, how can I maintain that and do I have to, and then does it become too stressful to maintain it? And then can I just let it go? Or, yeah, what can I let go of that stresses me? So, yeah.
Nice. So just in wrapping, what feeds you
I like to
now?
go to the sauna. That's actually my main hobby in my life. But what also feeds me is having this very stable job where I have lots of space for creativity and lots of agency, and we have lovely leadership who just lets us do what we want because they always see it's good. And the colleagues are really funny. And I used to be often very alone because I was the only PhD at my department, then I was the only postdoc. So all these peer groups I made were also because I'm lonely, and now there's people who are very aligned with what I do and from whom I could learn a lot because they were already there for a long time when I came, and they are also really funny. And so that feeds me, going to work, being able to set my own agenda, and being together with people who are, yeah, just nice and competent, and like taking obviously evenings, weekends, sauna time, holidays,
Oh, that
eating.
sounds brilliant. That sounds
Yes.
brilliant. Is there anything that you want to say that you wanted to say that we haven't said?
I made a few notes of talking points. Well, maybe just as an explainer of why I didn't know how academia works is because I didn't know anyone who worked in academia, and I still have very little friends who work in academia, and my family are in the Austrian railways or in the Austrian steelworks historically. So they were obviously liked public infrastructure, but weren't academically inclined. So I'm also conscious of that I have to explain things now because not everyone has the same background. And I'm also, yeah, sometimes puzzling how I am now, despite the fact that I suffered because I didn't know the rules. I can now translate these rules, make them more transparent, but I'm still in an environment that has many hierarchies because, yeah, I'm now support staff, and we like to say we feed the mission of research and not only researchers as people, but often it's also noticeable that there are hierarchies, and sometimes, well, the postdocs I work with are all brilliant and really appreciative, as are the PhD candidates and many professors as well. But sometimes you can notice, these hierarchies a little bit. Yeah.
Yes.
University leadership, not so much. They don't seem to have any sort of a need to claim their status. They are very
That they already firmly
provincial.
stand in it
Yeah.
as well.
That wasn't a very good ending word, but just to say, not everything is happy all the time.
Yeah. But
But
that
yeah.
we do have a lot of agency. You've pointed to
Yeah.
the multiple ways that we do have agency, the ways that we can contribute to one another by not assuming people know, by explaining, by reaching out, by saying we appreciate people, and also the power of community. So much of what you've talked about is connecting people and the wisdom and the expertise that we all have and share, whether it's of our fiascos, of our flops and tops or whatever. Like we,
Yeah,
yeah.
and on your own terms,
On your
use
own
it
terms.
as much as you can. Yeah.
Well, on your own terms, that's a great finish. Is that... Thank you so much. This has just been wonderful, Joanna. Really
Thanks,
appreciate your time.
Geraldine. Yes, it's super that you attentively listened to me for an hour and gave me the space to talk about myself. That's also feeding me.
Oh, that's good.
Thank you.
You can find the summary notes, a transcript, and related links for this podcast on www.changingacademiclife.com. You can also subscribe to Changing Academic Life on iTunes, Spotify, and I'm really hoping that we can widen the conversation about how we can do academia differently. And you can contribute to this by rating the podcast and also giving feedback. And if something connected with you, please consider sharing this podcast with your colleagues. Together, we can make change happen.